You're listening to the Doggeritaville podcast. I'm Laura.
And I'm Lily. We are two dog professionals with two different styles, two different backgrounds, and two common goals.
To drink delicious margaritas and talk about dogs.
Welcome to Doggeritaville.
Welcome to episode 4 of the Doggeritaville podcast. Today we're talking about popular dog myths. There are probably some pretty basic dog things that you've heard all your life that are actually completely false. We'll be debunking some of the more common ones while drinking our mango margaritas.
For every episode, each of us does our best to create a delicious margarita around our theme. We post the recipes on Instagram so you can try them at home. And if you have an idea for a theme, let us know. We'll keep you updated throughout the episode about how we feel about our drinks. We have different ideas of what makes the best mango margarita, so our recipes are going to differ, giving you some options.
All right, let's dive right into talking about dog myths. This is probably going to be a multi-part series. There's just a lot of bad information out there.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost impressive, honestly. So the first myth on the agenda is a pretty common one that we both hear all the time, I'm sure. Which is that a wagging tail means a happy dog. So I hear that all the time from my clients. A lot of my clients have dogs that have issues with visitors. And so they'll be like, oh, well, you know, he almost bit my friend that came over, but you know, their tail was wagging. I don't understand. And it's yep. Like, well, all right, let's dive into that.
So humans are obviously mostly verbal communicators. We're always speaking to each other and communicating that way. So we're not really used to picking up on a lot of verbal cues, but that's how dogs are almost always communicating, is with, visual cues. I said verbal cues, but visual cues.
You lost dogs me. I was like, wait, what?
Dogs are visual communicators. So they use their body language to communicate almost everything. And that means that they use their tails to communicate a lot of things as well. And a dog doesn't just have two moods, being happy and not happy, so there's going to be more than two ways to wag a tail. They need to communicate more than that.
A good thing that I like to kind of explain or show people is like hunting dogs. I mean, a lot of hunting dogs don't have tails, but the ones that do, like terriers, for instance, when they're hunting like rats and things, when their head is in that burrow, their tail is going like a mile a minute. Like, it's going nuts. It's not because they're so happy to see the rat, right? That is a very predatory tail wag. And there's a big difference between a predatory tail wag and just a normal, happy, lazy tail wag, right?
Yep. So sometimes the dog will wag his tail to signal discomfort or insecurity, which is when a lot of people get into the situation that Laura mentioned earlier, where it's like, oh, but he was wagging his tail and then my friend said hi and then they got bit. But like what's happening is the dog is wagging his tail. So the person's like, this dog is so happy. So then they enthusiastically approach and like bend over the dog and talk in a super high voice, even though the dog might have been saying like, I need a minute.
Right.
And then when the dog's communication was all ignored, we kind of put that dog into an inappropriate, uncomfortable situation and then punished them for it because they did something we weren't expecting because we thought they were happy. So in general, it's just best to let an unfamiliar dog approach you at their own pace, even if they are wagging their tail and they can tell you whether they want to interact with you or not. Another thing to keep in mind about tail wagging is that body language is not always going to be the same in every dog. Some things will differ by breed. Like, for instance, Laura brought up some dogs don't even have tails. Some dogs have tails that are tightly coiled to their bodies, and so their body language is going to be much different. Huskies have tails that are usually curled up over their backs, so their tail language is going to be different. And aside from breed, individual dogs will just use their tails differently. So it is important that if you see a wagging tail, you need to evaluate the rest of the dog. And as a general rule, if the dog is like nice and loose and wiggly, they're probably happy. And if they're stiff or low to the ground or panting really shallow or licking their lips, they are probably not wagging their tail because they're happy.
So one thing I thought was kind of interesting that my trainer that trained me, Danny Chavez, told me that I like did not believe him at first was that it's pretty across the board for the most part. That a low sitting tail means calm. And so I argued with him about this because, you know, Peter, his tail is up and curly. kind of like a husky or something like that. And so he was like, you know, you noticed his tail is always like that. And I'm like, yeah, dude, that's just what his tail's like. Like, what are you talking about? I've never seen it down. And he's like, exactly. And I'm like, are you a crazy person? But you know what? Per usual, Danny was 100% correct, because as soon as I started working Peter and really getting him to calm down, his tail's down almost all the time now. So even though, like, and that's not always true. There are breeds where, like, their tail does not uncurl. Don't get me wrong. But a lot of the times where we think, like, oh, yeah, his tail's just curly. That's where it's like, no, his tail can go down when he's chill. So that's something to take into consideration, too. Even dogs with, like, nubs, like my parents have Weimaraners, you can still watch that. Like, their tail still sticks up when they're alert. It still goes down when they're calm. It still tucks even when they're scared. Like, yeah, it's a nubbin, but I don't, is there like an accurate name for that? Because I just call them nubbins, but
I like nubbin.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a real name for it.
I got to meet Danny too when I came to Vegas to come visit Lara once, and he gave me some awesome body language advice, which was pick one element of your dog's body to like watch for like a week, and then the next week pick a different element of your dog's body to watch and just see what you learn about what they do with all those different body parts based on their various moods. So like pick a week watching their ears and see what makes them perk up or go back or go forward. And then look at the tail and see what makes it wag and what makes it go high, what makes it go low. Because even though there are definitely general rules across the board where you can pretty much tell what a dog is feeling like based on these general rules, there are individual things too that your dog will do based on their various moods. I thought that was a cool exercise. I think it's fun to do with your dog.
Danny's the best. I just love him. So the next myth, I mean, it's not really a myth in and of itself, I guess, is no kill animal shelters. So obviously, no kill is not a myth. It does exist. There are millions of them across the country. No kill shelters, they exist. However, how most people think of no kill shelters is not accurate. So the definition of a no kill shelter is a shelter with a 90% save rate or a live release rate. That just means that 90% of the healthy and treatable animals are leaving the building alive. So to be no kill is somewhat of a statistics game, I guess you could say. So it's harder for open admission shelters, which just means a shelter that takes everything that comes to it no matter what. Because obviously if you have to take everything, it's harder to adopt out everything if you're getting, you know, 200 dogs a day. But almost all limited admission shelters are no kill. Because obviously when you get to decide what pets to take in, you have more healthy and treatable animals, right? Generally speaking, no-kill shelters don't euthanize for space, because obviously that would be euthanizing healthy and treatable. They still can, technically, as long as it's under 10%, right? So it is a little bit of a numbers game. It's not just like, oh, we save all of them, right? Which I feel like is what most people think it is. Most people think that no kill is just we do not euthanize, period. And that is 100% not what it is.
Yeah. So I would say that's one of the myths around no kill shelters is that they are 100% no kill. But then I think another myth that's important to address is that it is more responsible to adopt from a no kill shelter. Not that it's irresponsible, but it is not relatively more responsible than adopting from somewhere else.
Yeah. I mean, I would even argue that adopting from a high-kill shelter is more important. Those are the dogs that need to get out.
So this is one of those areas where people are like, but wouldn't you say that you shouldn't buy from a backyard breeder even though the dogs need your help? But this is a different situation because if a high-kill shelter is a high-kill shelter, it's most likely that way because they are taking in every dog. Mm-hmm. And so there's still the same amount of dogs that need your help in the world. But now the high-kill shelter who takes in every dog is getting less money because they're getting less adoptions and now they have less resources to help the dogs that they do have.
Yeah, and I don't that's a road that is dangerous to go down, but I would also argue that if you don't buy from a backyard breeder, because yes, obviously that dog needs your help, but if you don't buy, what are they going to do with the dogs? They're going to give it to the county shelter.
Yeah.
Because they can't get rid of it. Whereas if you're buying it because it needs a place to go, that person is getting money for it and they're going to keep doing it.
Yep.
If they're not getting money for it, they're not going to keep doing it. That's the whole reason why they do it, right?
Yeah.
So that's a huge argument for me. So I'll stop there. But But yeah, so the big thing with no kill is not only do they still euthanize, of course, which is not a bad thing. That's just the reality of sheltering. You literally cannot save all of them. Some of them come in hit by cars and there's no saving them. Like, some animals have to be euthanized. That's just the reality of life. So I'm not, obviously, I work in rescue. I work with shelters every day. I'm not anti-no-kill shelter. But it just frustrates me that people don't understand what it actually is, right? So one of the big things with it is that healthy and treatable is extremely subjective. Our county shelter here is going no kill. I'm not sure if they've hit that 90% yet, but if not, they are very close. However, a dog can be euthanized for kennel stress, and that does not go against their 90% save rate because kennel stress considers it unhealthy.
Oh my
gosh.
It's
not a healthy dog, right? Which we know is bullshit.
Is there any regulation, or like, is it just the shelter
Zero.
Makes that regulation?
The shelter makes that regulation.
Wow.
So some shelters, one of the popular no-kill shelters in Seattle that I worked with, any of their dogs could be dog aggressive except for pit bulls. If their pit bulls were dog aggressive, they automatically got euthanized. If a lab was dog aggressive, it would be adoptable. Which in and of that just being prejudiced was also, that means that the pit bulls that they're euthanizing for not being good with other dogs also do not count to their 90% save rate because they are not healthy. They're not mentally sound or safe for adoption. So there's a lot of pitfalls within that 90% live release rate, right? It's not just their 90% of all animals are leaving out the front door. No, that's 90% of a certain percentage of the dogs that enter that building, right? Or cats, for that matter.
With issues that they also have other dogs that they're letting go and other dogs that are perhaps even bigger than pit bulls.
Yeah.
And
so that, and I mean, that's not my best example because that's just a prejudice policy in and of itself. And that was also like 12 years ago. So who knows if that shelter still has that policy. But yeah, so recently, and I tell this story all the time because it kills me. Our county shelter had a 6-month-old pitty returned for food aggression. The family was feeding it raw food. So that's just straight up meat in its bowl, right?
An extra valuable resource.
Yes. So one of the highest value things that you can give them. And he guarded the bowl. So they returned him. He didn't bite anybody. He just guarded the bowl. I don't know if he snapped at them or what. I know there was not a physical bite. I just know that he guarded in some way, shape, or form. Whether he growled and snapped or lunged, I don't know. But I know for sure there was no bite. They would not release this dog even to a behavior rescue like us. They would not give us the dog. They euthanized him because food aggression is dangerous to the public.
Would they have given you a different breed of dog who had that same issue?
Oh, I would almost guarantee it.
Cool.
But again, I don't want to get too far into like the prejudice of pit bulls because we'll be here for the rest of our lives. But like, that's what I mean. Like, that dog didn't count against their 90% save rate because he was quote unquote food aggressive. I would be willing to bet that one, he's 6 months old. Two, he was a stray. So had he just had a bowl of kibble, he might not have guarded it because it's not as high value. Or if you would work with him for 2 seconds, you could probably get him through it. So, I mean, that's one of the big kind of, not so much myths, I guess, but just the misunderstanding of no-kill shelters is that it's not what it seems when you think like, oh, they just don't kill animals. It's like, no. That is not what that is. So just know that no-kill shelters do euthanize. Most of it is very warranted. I'm not talking poorly on no-kill shelters, but also keep in mind that very basic behavior and sometimes even medical can still get a dog euthanized and have it not count towards their save percentage. So it's more of a misunderstanding than a myth.
Well, it's really important because, and I'm not like, again, I think we have to keep coming back to this. We're really not judging the average dog owner because, like, it's not your job to know. But it's really important to know because it has become this moral value that's been ascribed to adopting from a no-kill shelter. Every shelter has dogs that need to be adopted. And every shelter is putting down dogs in some form. And it's just not morally better for you to adopt from a no-kill shelter. So just keep it in mind.
In my opinion, you rescue a dog, you rescue a dog, right? As long as you're not putting money in the pockets of people that put them there in the first place, right?
Right.
So I hear that a lot. And again, we won't go down this road, but I hear this a lot with people that buy dogs from backyard breeders or shitty breeders. Well, I just had to get them out of there. I had to rescue them. And it's like, yeah, but you still gave them money.
Yep.
So you're still contributing to the cycle. I understand you see this puppy, you have to get it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not faulting you for that. I think I would even do that in that situation. But the bigger picture is you have to understand that any money that they get keeps them in that cycle because that's why they're doing it.
Yep. And I have seen that a lot too. And in my journey as a behavior mod trainer, I've seen a lot of people like, oh yeah, I got him from this breeder. And when I showed up, it was obvious that the conditions were not good. And so I didn't want to buy him from there, but I just couldn't leave him.
Exactly. And again, that's totally warranted. I don't expect anybody to walk away from that poor puppy that's living in filth. Don't get me wrong. But I would almost argue that like calling animal control or threatening to call animal control and trying to get the dog for free within this, obviously be safe. Don't get yourself murdered or anything.
Right. Very safely steal the dog. Right.
But a lot of the times, especially like if you start threatening animal control or depending on how animal control works in your town, if you call animal control when you leave, they're going to bust them anyways because most places breeding without a license is illegal. So if like in Vegas, our animal control is not that great because it's a massive city with almost no funding for animal control. So if we call in a backyard litter, they may or may not ever show up. But if they do, they're going to seize the puppies because you legally can't have more than 3 dogs and legally all your pets have to be spayed and neutered unless you have a license. So if you can get them to show up, that might be a better option and then you can get the puppy from the shelter or wherever. But anyways, that was a big tangent. But no kill shelters.
All right. So that was those were our 2 myths from segment 1. A wagging tail does not necessarily mean a happy dog, and a no-kill shelter does in fact euthanize dogs, which is not a bad thing. So we'll take a break now, and when we come back, we will be hitting you with 2 more dog myths. Margarita check. Lara, how did you make your mango margarita today?
I had a little bit of trouble with this one, and I don't know if it's just because the watermelon margaritas were so good that it just sabotaged everything else.
They really ruined us for all future margaritas.
I think they did. I think we need to take a break from like fruity margaritas and move on to something else for a bit. So I had a little bit of trouble. I did quite a few trials. The first trial I tried to do on the rocks with just mango nectar, and that was awful. It was no good. It was so bad. It was super sweet and it didn't particularly taste like mango. It was a whole thing. Today I did it kind of like my other trial run where I blended it with fresh mango. So I chopped up 2 fresh mangoes. I did 2 ounces of tequila. I still did 1 ounce of mango nectar, but I got a different, like more organic mango nectar because I think the first one was just like super sugary and crappy.
And is that, like, is mango nectar different from mango juice? Like, what is that?
I'm still trying to figure it out. So, so the first one that I tried was, like, a super generic, like, Kirk's mango nectar or whatever. That was the one that was, like, way too sweet. And I don't know if it's because it was on the rocks or what. I'm not sure what went wrong. But then I looked at it and, like, the first 2 ingredients are water and sugar and then mango. So I was like, oh, okay, that's the problem. But then I got a different mango nectar, which I also was kind of hesitant about because it was like mango was the first ingredient, but then the second ingredient was apple juice. And I was like, what's going on here?
That so, is interesting.
Yeah, I'm really confused. But the second mango nectar with the apple juice was actually much better. So I still did 1 ounce mango nectar because in one of my trials, when I just did fresh mango, it didn't taste enough like mango and it wasn't sweet enough. So I did the mangoes and the mango nectar. I did 2 juice limes, 1 ounce triple sec, and then 1 teaspoon agave. It's decent.
I made this 2 ways as well. The way that I tried the other day, I did on the rocks. And the situation that I was in was I didn't want to go to the store and I had cans of diced mangoes in my pantry. And so I just opened a can of diced mangoes and used the juice from the can. And lime and triple sec and tequila and just shook it and strained it. And it was really good. But the one that I made today, I did blended. So after I juiced the can of mango, I flash froze the canned mango itself. And then I blended that into my margarita from today. And I wrote down that it was 2.5 cups of frozen mango, but that does not sound right. So
seems like a lot of mango.
I did 3 ounces of tequila, 1 juiced lime, and then maybe like half the can or a third of the can of the diced mango frozen. 3/4 ounce of triple sec, which brings out the flavor of the mango, I think, a lot. And I blended it, and I did not put anything on my rim today. And it is very, very good.
Next myth. The next myth we want to talk about is a big one. It's a big one. The myth is that dogs are descended from wolves, which is primarily important because you only hear about that in regards to the dreaded alpha theory. I'll let Lily dive into that because I know she's dying too.
Here we go. So we're going to back up a little bit to the 1940s. We're going way, way back. So in the 1940s, a study on wolf behavior found that wolves are pack animals who establish a hierarchical structure within their packs based on tests of dominance. And it was observed in this study that each wolf was always trying to establish its place as the alpha, and the wolf who was consistently the most dominant was the one who got to stay the alpha while the rest of the wolves submitted to that wolf. That is where alpha theory comes from in dog training. Since dogs descended from wolves, which we're about to debunk, we can presumably learn about their behavior from the behavior of wolves. And since wolves are constantly engaging in tests to determine dominance, we should be doing that in our homes. We should be establishing our place as the head of the house by doing things like not allowing the dogs to eat before we do, or constantly controlling their resources, or never allowing them on our furniture. Which I don't, but not for that reason. or always going through the door first before the dog. And then, of course, in some extreme cases, we should be physically dominating our dogs by rolling them, kicking them, and any other manner of things to establish our roles as the alphas.
Alpha roles, man. Alpha roles honestly just leave me speechless. Like, I don't know where or why that would ever be a solution to any problem ever for any reason ever. Like,
that's what wolves do to each other, Laura.
I don't understand. You think your dog thinks you're a dog? Like, I don't understand.
I am more baffled by how many alpha roles have been performed in the world without the dog then tearing your face off.
Right? I was just actually having this conversation today. There was a guy at a boarding facility that was getting complaints about being too rough with the dogs. And this particular boarding facility is where 3 of my dogs have to board because they will get kicked out of anywhere else. Honestly, I'm not worried about it because anybody even raises a hand to these dogs and you're gonna get mauled. Like, that's what's gonna happen. Like, I can't imagine trying to alpha roll these dogs. Like, I would die. I would literally get murdered. Like, what, dude?
And I can't imagine alpha rolling any dog because, like, even my dog Mooney, who's, like, really friendly and loves belly rubs, like, sometimes I try to push him over for a belly rub and I can't.
Yeah.
Like,
right?
How do you even do it?
Well, yeah. And on the other end of the spectrum is, like, Peter. Yeah, of course I'm not going to alpha roll one of my aggressive dogs because, of course, they'll bite me. But even my scared shitless dog is still going to bite me because he's going to panic.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
We'll move on from alpha rolls. So, anyway, that's where alpha theory comes from, is from that study on wolves. But this entire study was debunked decades ago, and alpha theory with it, for a few different reasons. First of all, the study was conducted on groups of captive wolves who were not family members, where wolves in the wild are indeed pack animals, but the packs consist of a family, so it's a male, a female, and their offspring. And there are no dominance contests within the pack because there are adults and children.
Well, and that's, so I never, because I don't give a shit about dominance theory. So I've never, like, looked into why it was debunked. I just have always accepted that it's bullshit, right? But so I never really looked into, like, how it was debunked. I was just like, yeah, of course it's dumb. And when I found out that that's where it comes from, like, a crap study on, a way that wolves don't even really live. I was like, wait.
Yeah.
Hold the phone. So you're telling me generations of dog owners have been doing this to their dogs based on a completely BS study? Yeah, when I found out that that's where the entire precipice came from. Is that the right use of precipice?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so. As it came out of my mouth, I was like, I don't think that's right.
A precipice is like a cliff.
Yeah, that's what I thought. What's the word I'm thinking of?
Precedent?
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, I was absolutely mind blown.
And not only because that is not how wolves actually live in the wild, but also we now know that dogs did not actually descend from wolves, at least not the wolves that we know and are familiar with. So there's no reason to believe that knowing more about wolf behavior would tell us anything about dog behavior. So modern wolves and dogs are both descended from the same ancestor, which is likely some kind of wolf from tens of thousands of years ago, but they were not descended from wolves that are alive today. And on top of that, dogs have been domesticated for tens of thousands of years, and even most species of feral dogs are not pack animals like the modern wolf. So there's just so many reasons that this is not a study that should tell us how to train our dogs.
So I will say I was kind of surprised by that, though, because when I saw in the show notes that, like, dogs are not descended from wolves, I was like, wait a second, aren't they, though? Like, not that any of that stuff is true, but, like, they're obviously descended from the same thing. So that's where I got a little bit confused, even in the show notes, was just like, well, I mean, I think they are kind of. I mean, maybe not how we think of wolves now, but like they are descended from the same thing, right?
Well, I might be about to make myself sound really stupid because I don't know much about evolution, but like,
I don't either. hence my confusion.
Well, I think that we and chimpanzees are also descended from a similar relative, but you can't like learn about human behavior by studying chimpanzee behavior, right? Like, we're totally different.
Okay, so that makes sense. And that's what I was thinking because I was like, so like, are we then not descendant from chimpanzees? Because I feel like we are. Okay, so that makes sense. So we are kind of, but just not in the way that you would normally think of. It's not like we domesticated wolves and that's how dogs happened, right?
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So this theory kind of comes from the theory that wolves were domesticated and turned into dogs. But in fact, wolves that exist today and dogs that exist today both evolved from the same animal, but they're totally different animals.
So that makes more sense. Because even I didn't know that. I was like, what's she talking about? Dogs aren't descended from wolves. They're the same thing. I mean, they're very much not the same thing. But
so all that to say, dogs descending from wolves is a myth, and therefore alpha theory is a myth. So if a trainer is pushing alpha theory on you, that is a good indication that they have not learned anything new in literally decades, because this has been debunked for many decades. And they need to be fired. And also, if there are any trainers who claim to understand dog behavior because they've worked with wolves, that's another really good indication that they don't have an education in dog behavior. And they might indeed have a terrific education in wolf behavior. I can't say that they don't and won't say that they don't, but that doesn't mean they know anything about dogs.
I will argue that just a little bit. Like, obviously, I'm not into alpha theory, and I understand that you can't learn about dogs from studying wolves. But again, they are both in the canine species, or however you want to say it. So I feel like you can learn things about behavior from wolves. I get what you're saying as far as like, you're not going to treat a wolf and a dog the same way. But I think it can teach you a lot as far as like instincts and timing and stuff like that. Just like, I mean, it could with any animal. So I won't fully agree with you there, but I get what you're saying.
I think that we, as usual, I think the same thing and are just like saying a little bit different things. Like, I think that there can be things that are similar between wolves and dogs, but you need to make sure that that behavior is the same. Like, just because it's a behavior for a wolf does not mean that it is a behavior for a dog.
Well, and most aversive trainers are the ones that are that are like, oh yeah, I've worked with wolves for years, and it's like, right, that's great. Have you worked with dogs for years?
Right. Or have you also taken a lesson about dogs? Like, any lesson at all?
Yeah.
Like,
but I will say, I think working with wolves can definitely make you a better dog trainer. Not that they're correlated at all. Like, as far as like, you're not going to handle them the same way or do the same stuff. I always tell people that I train dogs a little bit more the way that you train like horses, and that you're not going to force a horse to do anything, right? And that's kind of more how we should approach dogs, in that we're not forcing them to do stuff. We're trying to kind of convince them to make that choice, right?
And I think that that is actually how a lot of modern dog training techniques kind of became discovered, was through training dolphins and training horses, because mm-hmm. those are two animals that you can't coerce to do much of anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've just, like, from following people on Instagram and stuff, I generally get more out of, like, the horse trainers that I follow than the dog trainers that I follow.
So I think we've talked that one out. Yeah. So our next our next myth that we're going to go over is the myth that old dogs can't learn new tricks.
Where did this even come from? Like, why would a dog just hit a certain age and stop learning? I don't understand.
Well, and that's a phrase that's used to, like, talk about humans who yeah. also don't reach a certain age and stop learning.
I feel like it's honestly just code for, like, this person or this dog is an asshole. Like, that's all it means.
They're set in their ways.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's where, like, I can kind of understand, because obviously if you have had a dog since it was 8 weeks old and you've always let it up on the couch, and then at 8 years old you're like, hey, you're not allowed on my furniture anymore. Yeah, it's going to be a little bit harder to teach them that. Not impossible by any means. But it's going to be a little bit harder because 8 years later, you're randomly saying, hey, we're not doing that anymore. Right?
Right.
And they're like, wait, what? I've done this literally my whole life. So that's the only thing that I can think as far as, like, where it came from. But it's still just, like, total crap. Dogs can always adapt and learn just about anything at any time, regardless of age. If a dog isn't learning something, we are almost always missing something in the way that we're trying to teach them or in our consistency in enforcing the new rules, right?
Yeah. I just learned the other day that in humans, something that you can do to help prevent things like dementia and Alzheimer's is be continually learning new things, like learn a new language or learn how to play a new game or something. And yeah. I wonder if it's similar with dogs. Like, I wonder if we're doing them a total disservice by stopping their learning at some point.
I would almost guarantee it. That wasn't a very good myth. I wanted it to be better.
That's okay. I think that we could use one that was a little bit shorter, because I think
yeah, that's true.
The rest of ours are going to be longer.
The wolf one got a little long.
I think they've all gotten a little long so far.
Yeah.
We talked about no kill fur. I mean, there's like two yeah. sentences written on it, and we talked about it for like a half hour.
It's okay. I was, per usual, worried about this being too short, and I think it's going to be perfect, actually.
Yeah, I think so. So those are two more dog myths for you. We'll go ahead and take another break here, and when we get back, we will get you two more. Margarita check. Lara, how are you enjoying your marg?
It's almost gone. definitely not my favorite, but I do feel like I did everything that I could to make it as good as it could be. I'm kind of surprised that it's not my favorite, because usually, like, at a restaurant and stuff, I usually do order the mango. But yeah, definitely not my favorite, but good. I mean, I figured it out by the third or fourth try. We got to switch off the fruit for a little while, I think.
And do what, like a celery margarita?
Can you not make me puke out my margarita as I'm drinking it, please? Thank you. No, I haven't looked at our schedule. I don't know what's next. I think the next one is still a fruit one, which I might change.
But, like, what would be an example of a non-fruit margarita?
Like apples, which I guess is still a fruit one, but...
Apple!
Fuck off. I think someone posted the apple cider margarita. I do really want to try that one. I'm a little concerned about it because apple and lime are not two things that I want to put together. But I don't know. There's that, again, it is another fruit one, but it's just like the watermelon and the mango, I feel like, are really close together.
Okay.
Listen, I'm not talking to you about this anymore. I quit. I quit. You're an asshole. Oh, next one just says blue margarita. I don't know what that means, but I'm excited.
Just make it blue.
Yeah.
That's kind of a fun one. Not to have a flavor, but like a color.
Right. Oh, sangria margarita. Also fruit. So I guess I misspoke, as you so nicely pointed out. We don't need to get away from fruit margaritas, but just away from the ones that you have to blend, I think, is my issue.
Well, not that you asked, but I'm also really enjoying my mango margarita.
I forgot. I forgot to ask.
There's about a third of it left, and I think that I'll be done with it very soon. So the next myth that we want to address is the myth that dogs understand right from wrong. So I commonly get questions from dog owners about why their dogs do things even though they know it's wrong. So as an example, like, he knows he's not allowed on the furniture, but he jumps up anyway. Or she knows she shouldn't take food off our plates, but she does it anyway. And so the myth that I want to address is the idea that dogs know what they should and should not be doing.
Yeah, I mean, my instinct to people that say that, like, he knows he's not allowed on the furniture, but he gets up anyways. Well, then no, he obviously does not know that, right? Like, right. So I hear that a lot with clients. It's just like, he knows this, but he doesn't do it. And I'm like, well, if he's not doing it, then he obviously doesn't know it, right?
Right.
You're literally, the answer is right there in your sentence. So that's, I mean, that's frustrating for me. For me, I don't think about it in the terms of, like, dogs knowing right for wrong. I just think about it in terms of owners not understanding that obviously their dog does not know because you have not trained them enough or appropriately.
Which I think it comes directly from that myth that, like, people think that, you know, if my dog loves me enough or whatever, then he's going to be doing what I say because I'm in charge and I make the rules and whatever. But the fact is that dogs don't really understand the concept of rules. Like, they don't understand that we have a right and wrong and we want them to obey us. Every behavior that a dog does is just a dog behavior. There's no moral value behind it. There's no good or bad ascribed to it. And of course, there are behaviors that we like and behaviors that we don't like. And so we kind of want to make sure that the dog is only doing behaviors that we like. But the dog doesn't know that. So rather than operating in terms of right and wrong, dogs operate in terms of what works for them. So they're doing things that make them comfortable and happy and avoiding things that make them feel uncomfortable or cause them stress. And so when an owner says, my dog knows this but doesn't do it, like the way that you would explain it is you, obviously the dog doesn't know it, you need to teach him till he knows it. And then what I would say is that's not working for him. And again, we're saying the same thing, like, inwardly amongst ourselves as trainers who understand dog behavior. But I think to an owner, it makes a difference to, like, know that there is no point at which your dog will just, like, know that you want him to do this and that's why he's doing it. It's like, we have to make it so that it works for him to do it.
Yeah, just as far as, like, reinforcing it appropriately.
That is one way, and that's my preferred way. But, like, you know, like, let's take sit as an example. So, like, if you teach your dog to sit with treats, then your dog learns when my mom says sit, or dad, I'm not a sexist, when my mom or dad says sit, and I put my butt on the ground, amazing things happen. So that works. Like, I might as well just do that because I'm going to get a treat or a toy or a something. But dogs could also learn, of course, through if my mom or dad says sit and I don't do it, then I get shocked or I get yelled at or I get hit or whatever it is. And so I should put my butt on the ground because I'm avoiding this unpleasant thing that's going to happen. And so it's not that the dog is like, oh, my mom or dad says to sit and I love them and so I'm going to do it and obey them. It's like, yeah, I've learned that it works for me to do this, whether for a good reason or a bad reason.
Yeah.
And so the reason I think that this is important to know is because knowing how dogs learn, for me anyway, has been the best way to learn how to teach them. Like, if we really think that our dog knows right from wrong and deliberately disobeys us, I think that that puts people in a situation where they're either bribing the dog with rewards because they think that it will make the dog love them, and then they accidentally reinforce a bunch of weird behaviors. Or on the flip side, they might start really punishing that dog super hard because they think it will make the dog respect them and therefore do what they ask for that reason. And that, of course, will create an anxious, fearful, shut down, aggressive dog. So I think that if we understand how dogs learn, it just helps us be the most effective teachers. But if we keep in mind that dogs are always just doing what works for them, and we know that the dog is either following a comfort or avoiding a discomfort, then we can assess what's going on, manage things the most effective way, and be the best possible trainer. So I want us all to shift our mindset from, my dog needs to do what I say because I'm in charge, because that's not how our dogs are thinking, so it's going to be fruitless for us to think that way. So instead, I think we should be evaluating how we can teach the dog which behaviors are going to work for them when they're living in our world. And I don't want to sound like that you have to just let your dog get away with everything, But I'm just trying to frame it like the behaviors that you want your dog to do, you need to make it work out for your dog to do that.
I'm too many margaritas deep to argue that.
What would you argue about it?
I mean, it's not that, I think like you said, it's not that we disagree. It's just that's not the way I arrived to that same conclusion. It never crosses my mind that dogs don't know right from wrong. That never has been a thought in my head.
But it's been a thought in your clients' heads, right? Like they say stuff like that too.
Well, yeah, but that's not the way that it's like, I would just explain it in that, no, he obviously doesn't know that because you haven't reinforced it. I'm not going to dive into, well, he doesn't know that because that's not how his brain works. Like, my mind just glosses over when people talk like that. And I'm like, yeah, dude, okay, the science behind it, great. The reality is of it that you haven't taught him the behavior enough. I don't need to go into the science behind it. Which, I mean, obviously the science behind it is what gets me there. I just don't think about the science behind it, I guess.
Well, that is one of the things that has really shaped the way that I work with dogs, and I have found it to be really helpful explaining it to a lot of my clients, so I just like to go over it, just in case someone out there finds it helpful.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, like, how a lot of people learn. My brain just immediately shuts off when people start talking about stuff like that. I don't know what it is. If you just use different terminology and explain it to me, I'm like, oh great, got it, cool, we're good. But for some reason when people are like, well actually the dog's brain blah blah blah, I'm just instantly check out. I can't do it.
I really like to know the mechanics of things.
I don't at all. I just need how to get from point A to point B. And that is it. I don't have time for the details. Yeah, so the next myth is one that I hear a lot, and I don't know if that is why people are against crates, is because this is how they think of them or what, but I guess I should say the myth, huh? So I guess the myth would be that crates are punishment, or that crates are bad. Most of the time when I have people that are against kennels, but for whatever reason we need to use them, and I don't mean that their dog needs to be in a kennel for 8 hours while they're at work. I just mean we need to use them in some regard, whether it be that they're eating in them or they need to go in when visitors come over or whatever it is. Almost every time, their instinct is to put the dog in the kennel when the dog does something wrong. So using the crate as punishment. Again, I don't know where this came from. Did this used to be a thing? Like, is that how trainers used to use kennels? I've never heard of it that way, but for some reason, so many average dog owners, I think even you said, like, that's how you guys used to use kennels, right? Like, the average person, that is how they think kennels are supposed to be used.
That's one way that we use them. Like, we also used it to crate the dog at appropriate times, but like, yeah, when he was quote unquote bad, like when he got in trouble, like it was in the crate.
Yeah. And that's even one of my clients I have right now, their dog is having some trouble resource guarding. So I was like, well, we're going to need to start kennel training. And they were like, oh, man. And they were kind of disappointed. And I was like, I mean, she's guarding rooms, like she's guarding people from other people, like she's guarding. It's not resource, like it is resource guarding, but it's not the generic resource guarding in that it's like toys or food that we can easily manage. She's guarding things that are really hard to manage. So there's really not an easy way to manage her other than starting to use a kennel a little bit, even if it's just for small periods of time. And they were like, oh yeah, well she did the guarding and we put her in the kennel. And I was like, whoa, 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 what? No. That is not, no. And they literally had no idea that you don't use crates as punishment. And they shouldn't. I mean, again, that's not for them to know, but it's like, I even looked into it for this episode because I was like, where the hell did this come from? And I can't, I can't find anything that's not don't ever use the crate as punishment. So I don't know where it came from. I don't know if it's just like the human psychology of I feel bad about putting my dog in the kennel, so it's obviously a bad place, so it's obviously a punishment.
Well, I think like we think of it as like, you know, isolation, right? Like, yeah. I wouldn't want to be put in a crate, so why would my dog want to be put in a crate? Like, not thinking about...
But you do, though. Like, you like hanging out in your own bedroom.
Yeah. But, like, not in a space that's as big as I am. But, like, dogs are denning animals, and so they just think a little bit differently about it. But, yeah, to me, it's like, well, I wouldn't want that to happen to me, so it's probably a punishment.
That's the only thing that's the only thing I can think is just the human psychology of it turns it into that. But, like, the average person, almost every time, I feel like, is like, oh, yeah, he pottied in the house, so I put him in his kennel. And it's like, no. please don't do that. So, yeah, crates are not meant to be used as punishment. If you're going to use them that way, please just don't get one. Please don't get a dog or a kennel. But, yeah, crates are never meant to be punishment. Kennels should always, always, always be a positive place. That's literally the whole reason that they exist.
Yes.
It's for a safe place that you can manage your dog in general, whether it's just so that you have space or so that they have space. That's all it's meant to be, is just a safe place of management.
Yep.
That's it. That's all it is. So yeah, I don't know where the crates as punishment myth came from. I don't know why it exists. I've never in my life heard anyone recommend using it that way. False. Don't ever do it.
Don't do it.
Don't do it.
There you have it.
I kind of like this episode just because we get to be bossy and tell people what not to do.
We can make more of those.
Yeah, I'm in.
Okay, so those are our two more of our myths. And we'll take one final break. And when we get back, we will have two more myths for you. Surprise, surprise, surprise.
But wait, there's more. Final margarita check. I am out of my margarita, so I have nothing to say for this. How is your margarita? Where are you at?
Almost done now. Yeah, feeling pretty good.
I don't think I would change anything. I mean, it wasn't that, it was good, but it wasn't great. But I feel like I changed it enough in my test runs that it's not going to get any better, I don't think.
Sure.
And it's good. I mean, I liked it. It's not that I didn't like it. It just wasn't as good as I wanted it to be, I don't think.
I liked mine. I don't think I would change anything about it. So the last myth that I picked was the myth that it's all how they're raised. Which is a popular phrase to say about pit bulls. And as you probably know, pit bulls have reputations of being aggressive. And I want to say right off the bat that their reputation is absolute bullshit. Laura and I absolutely agree about that. And maybe that's a myth that we can tackle on like part two or something. I don't know. Breed-specific legislation is bullshit. The reputation of the pit bull is bullshit. That being said, many people respond to that myth with another myth, which is it's all how they're raised. Meaning a pit bull will only be aggressive if he's abused or if he's taught how to be that way or if he was used as a fighting dog or something. And that is just not true.
Don't even get me started on the fighting dog. So I won't go too far into this again, but literally like any stray pit bull that is found that doesn't even have a mark on it, like not a single scar. People are like, it was a bait dog. I'm like, I don't... It doesn't have a single mark on it. What the hell do you mean it was a bait dog? All the time. Like, I see this at least once a month. Like, regularly. Oh, it was probably a fight dog that escaped. And I'm like, this perfectly healthy, not a scratch on it dog you think was a fight dog? All right, cool. Good talk. Mm-hmm. So, no, not every pit bull is a bait dog or a fight dog. In fact, that is pretty rare, especially on the West Coast. There are other parts of the country it is not rare. But on the West Coast, it's pretty damn rare. Not that it doesn't happen here. But it's the exception, not the rule.
Right. So any dog can be aggressive. There are a variety of factors that come into play on that. How they're raised is one of the factors. But how they're bred is another factor. Medical conditions could be a factor. They're... you know, like not socialized correctly during their fear period is a factor. Like there's lots of reasons that any single dog could be aggressive, and it is not an indicator that the dog was abused or mistreated or raised poorly. And there are many dogs who were raised in loving homes who are aggressive. There are also many, many dogs who are rescued from fighting rings and abusive situations who go on to live happy, peaceful lives. So there's always an element of nature versus nurture. And when we say it's all how they're raised, It's erasure of loving dog owners who did their best and still ended up with an aggressive dog. And it's an erasure of dogs who have overcome horrible circumstances to live wonderful lives.
Yeah, so I think we've talked about it before. I'm part of a Facebook group for behavior euthanasia. And that term is highly triggering for those people. Not to say those, like, I've done behavior euths too. It's not like those people that have done that. But just like it triggers people a ton because it does indicate like, oh, you did something wrong if your dog ended up this way, right?
Right.
Which is obviously just completely not true. I won't tell any more Charlie stories because I feel like I've said them on every single episode. But obviously he was very well socialized, things like that, right? It didn't help us so much. But yeah, it is a very breed-specific thing. You never really hear that about other breeds. It's almost always just pit bulls. I don't think I've ever heard that terminology regarding any other breed of dog, right? So yeah, I mean, like Lily said, there is nature versus nurture. How you raise them does help or make a difference, but it is not the end-all be-all, right? So that sentiment is misleading for sure.
Yeah. And then especially because it is about just one specific breed, it's almost sending the message that like, well, of course, pit bulls are inherently aggressive. But if you raise them correctly, then they won't be.
Exactly.
Yeah. And yeah, that's just absolutely not true. You cannot just love an animal out of aggression. And please don't try to do that. And pit bulls are not inherently more aggressive than other breeds.
That kind of leads us into our last segment of just like different breed specific myths in general. Like they don't have locking jaws. I always thought that was kind of like a joke. Like, oh, people don't really think that.
They do.
I heard it last weekend. One of my fosters, Harry Potter, had a meet and greet. And the lady that was meeting him for potential adoption asked about lock jaws. And this is an older lady that supposedly had pit bulls before. And she still asked me. I've had clients that have pit bulls that think their dogs have locking jaws. I had a client that had a pit. And she believed with her whole heart that her dog was inherently aggressive and had lock jaws. I bought her a book on pit bulls. Because I was like, lady, you cannot own this dog thinking that. And her dog was nice. There's nothing wrong with her dog. It's not like that's why she thought. Like, she just believed that that's what pit bulls were and she got one anyway.
Well, I don't understand even, like, where that comes from.
Like, I don't either.
Because, like, what would the mechanics of that be? Like, just a dog who cannot open its mouth once it has closed it? Like,
yeah. So I can kind of see where it comes from. Because I don't know what you would call it, the physicality of their jaws looks so different than a normal dog.
Like they have a little square head kind of, or?
Well, I mean, like a normal dog smiles, you don't see 4 inches of freaking jaw muscle, right? Like,
that's true. Yeah.
When Charlie and Noble get really tired, like when they're panting hard and they open their mouth, you see a huge freaking chunk of muscle in there. You don't see that on normal dogs. They're not built that way, right? I shouldn't have said normal dogs. I apologize. You don't see that on Labradors or, you know, Basenjis or other breeds of dogs, right? You see it a little bit on like Mastiffs and things like that, but you don't see this huge mouth muscle, right? Like,
yeah.
So I think just seeing that automatically, people are like, whoa, you got some muscles in there, buddy. And then because they're terriers, and you find this too in other terriers like Dachshunds or other small breed terriers that I can't think of any. But it's the same thing when they're hunting badgers and rats. They're not just dropping the damn thing, are they? No, they're holding on to that thing for dear life and they're shaking. Unless they're trying to do otherwise, right? But like, that's how they kill it, is they shake it and they grip it. Like, that is literally what terriers are trained to do. To grab on and not let go. They are tenacious. That is a terrier. So when you have a large muscle-bound terrier instead of a tiny little cute terrier, yeah, it does kind of seem like they have locking jaws because they are bred not to let go.
Well, and I've never heard that any other breed has a locking jaw, even breeds that do bite work, like Germans and Belgians.
Yeah. It's very strange. There is no locking mechanism on any mammal's jaw, I would argue. It's bonkers to me, but I see where it came from because of that. Because they are so tenacious that if you are trying to get them to open their mouth on something that they have, good luck. But when you look at it intelligently, it's like, that's physically impossible, bro. Like, what are you even talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. And I want someone to draw me a diagram of what that looks like. Like, how does the dog access the locking mechanism? Yeah.
How do you lock and unlock? Right. That's a good question. Is there a beeper key? Like, is there a remote strap to this?
Do you have to swipe on it? Yeah. Or Face ID or something?
If he moves his bottom jaw forward, it enables. it's ridiculous. So Lily already touched on inherent aggression. Obviously, I don't think any dog or breed can be inherently aggressive. Aggression cannot be characterized by breed. And I think that kind of comes more from they were bred to take down large animals. So just like hunting dogs tend to have more of a prey drive, they tend to have more of a prey drive with other animals. Not to say that they can't be animal friendly, but that's what they were bred to do, is to take down big animals. So yeah, they're not inherently aggressive. It's impossible for a dog breed in and of itself to be inherently aggressive.
Right.
That's not how aggression works. And then I think the last and final one that I hear almost as much as lockjaws is that they don't feel pain.
I have never heard that.
You've never? Oh gosh.
No.
It's definitely not as popular as some of the others, but I do hear it a lot. And again, it's just rooted in the fact that they are tenacious terriers. So yeah, they'll tolerate quite a lot, especially when their adrenaline's going. I know, I mean, even for us humans, like, when our adrenaline's going, we don't know that we got cut or we got bit, right? Like, breaking up a dog fight, both my hands and arms were shredded. I didn't feel it until the next day because I was trying to break up two dogs trying to kill each other. Yeah. I didn't even notice that my hands and wrists were shredded until obviously after the fact when I had to go to the hospital. But in the moment, I'm not like, oh, I got to stop breaking up this fight. I got bit. No, I don't feel it. You didn't
just like wake up the next morning like, oh, oops.
Whoops-a-doo. But especially like when they're hunting or fighting or whatever the case might be, they might not react to the pain in the same way because that adrenaline is coursing through. It's just like when people are in car accidents, right?
Yeah, when the body like goes through trauma, like I was hit by a truck and split my femur right in half, and I didn't feel any pain until I got to the hospital.
Exactly. Like, yeah. That adrenaline, on top of being a very large, very strong dog, on top of being a tenacious terrier, like all of these things combine to like where I could see where you might think that. But yeah, it's the same as us. When we're in a car crash, we're not like, oh, hold on a second, my phone's ringing. Like, no, I'm not worried about that right now. All right. You see it all the time, especially on like TV. Like somebody got shot and they don't realize it until 20 minutes later when the scene is like died down or whatever, right? So of course they feel pain. They feel pain the same way as every other dog feels pain. It's just, again, they are very strong and tenacious. So
pain is a very important survival tool.
Right.
Okay. We got through 8 myths. We got through a doobie throwing a fit back there. So that about wraps it up. Our 4th episode is ready to be let out of the kennel. You can find me on Instagram at Miss Lily's Dogs or on my website, MissLily'sDogs.com, or my online training platform, Patreon.com/MissLily'sDogs.
And you can find me on Instagram at ProperPuppersLV or my website, ProperPuppersLV.com. In our next episode, we will be drinking blue margaritas, which we're both mildly a little confused and curious about, and talking about mental enrichment, how you can provide it, and how much you should provide. Next time on the Doggeritaville podcast.
Thanks for listening to Doggeritaville.
Send us an email at doggeritaville@gmail.com
or send us a DM on Instagram @doggeritaville.
and let us know if there are any topics you'd like to see covered.
Or if there are any margaritas you want us to try.
And don't forget to leave us a review.
Until next time, give your dog a treat from us.